He did. Everything was clear now, and he thought he should have seen it earlier. Everything this girl's aunt had feared had been true. Rhea had known, although why she hadn't told anyone the girl had been screwing one of the in-world boys, Jonas didn't know. And Susan had done more than just screw Will Dearborn. She'd helped him escape, him and his trailmates, and she might well have killed two lawmen for him into the bargain. The figure in the ball swam closer. Watching that made him feel a little dizzy, but it was a pleasant dizziness. Beyond the girl was the hut, faintly lit by a lamp which had been turned down to the barest core of flame. At first Jonas thought someone was sleeping in one corner, but on second glance he decided it was only a heap of hides that looked vaguely human.
"Do we spy the boys?"
Rhea asked, seemingly from a great distance.
"Do we spy him, my Lord Sai?"
"No," he said, his own voice seeming to come from that same distant place. His eyes were pinned to the ball. He could feel its light baking deeper and deeper into his brain. It was a good feeling, like a hot fire on a cold night.
"She's alone. Looks as if she's waiting." "Aye."
Rhea gestured above the ball, a curt dusting-off movement of the hands, and the pink light was gone. Jonas gave a low, protesting cry, but no matter, the ball was dark again. He wanted to stretch his hands out and tell her to make the light return, to beg her if necessary, and held himself back by pure force of will. He was rewarded by a slow return of his wits. It helped to remind himself that Rhea's gestures were as meaningless as the puppets in a Pinch and Gilly show. The ball did what it wanted, not what she wanted. Meanwhile, the ugly old woman was looking at him with eyes that were perversely shrewd and clear.
"Waiting for what, do we suppose?" she asked.
There was only one thing she could be waiting for, Jonas thought with rising alarm. The boys! The three beardless sons of bitches from Inworld! And if they weren't with her, they might well be up ahead, doing their own waiting. Waiting for him. Possibly even waiting for...
"Listen to me," he said. "I'll only speak once, and you best answer true. Do they know about that thing? Do those three boys know about the rainbow?"
Her eyes shifted away from his. It was answer enough in one way, but not in another. She had had things her way all too long up there on her hill. She had to know who was boss down here. He leaned over again and grabbed her shoulder. It was horrible, like grabbing a bare bone that somehow still lived, but he made himself hold on all the same, and squeeze. She moaned and wriggled, but he held on.
"Tell me, you old bitch! Run your fucking gob!" "They might know of it," she whined. "The girl might have seen something the night she came to me. Arr! Let go, you're killing me."
"If I wanted to kill you, you'd be dead." He took another longing glance at the ball, then sat up straight in the saddle, cupped his hands around his mouth, and called,
"Clay, hold up!"
As Reynolds and Renfrew reined back, Jonas raised a hand to halt the Vax behind him. The wind whispered through the grass, bending it, rippling it, whipping up eddies of sweet smell. Jonas stared ahead into the dark, even though he knew it was fruitless to look for them. They could be anywhere, and Jonas didn't like the odds in an ambush, not one bit. He rode to where Clay and Renfrew were waiting. Renfrew looked impatient.
"What's the problem? Dawn'll be breaking soon. We ought to get a move on. Do you know the hut's in the bad grass?"
"Aye, most. Why, do you know one with a red door?"
Renfrew nodded and pointed northish.
"Well, old Sunni's place.
He had some sort of religious conversion, a dream or a vision or something. That's when he painted the door of his hut red. He's gone to the Manny folk these last 5 years.
He no longer asked why, at least. He had seen something on Jonas's face that had shut up his questions. Jonas raised his hand, looked at the blue coffin tattooed there for a second, then turned and called for Quint.
"You're in charge," Jonas told him.
Quint's shaggy eyebrows shot up.
"Me?"
"Yeah, but you're not going on. There's been a change of plan."
What? Listen, and don't open your mouth again unless there's something you don't understand. Get that damn black cart turned around. Put your men around it and hie on back the way we came. Join up with Lengel and his men. Tell them Jonas says wait where you find him until he and Reynolds and Renfrew come. Clear? Quint nodded. He looked bewildered, but said nothing. Good. Get about it. And tell the witch to put her toy back in its bag. Jonas passed a hand over his brow. Fingers which had rarely shaken before had now picked up a minute tremble. It's distracting. Quint started away, then looked back when Jonas called his name. I think those in-world boys are out here, Quint. Probably ahead of where we are now, but if they're back the way you're going, they'll probably set on you. Quint looked nervously around at the grass, which rose higher than his head. Then his lips tightened and he returned his attention to Jonas. If they attack, they'll try to take the ball, Jonas continued. And sigh, mark me well. Any man who doesn't die protecting it will wish he had. He lifted his chin at the Vax, who sat astride their horses in a line behind the black cart. Tell them that.
Aye, boss, Quint said.
When you reach Langill's party, you'll be safe.
How long should we wait for you if you don't come?
Till hell freezes over. Now go.
As Quint left, Jonas turned to Reynolds and Renfrew.
We're going to make a little side trip, boys, he said.
Ten. Roland. Alain's voice was low and urgent. They've turned around. Are you sure?
Yes.
There's another group coming along behind them, a much larger one. That's where they're headed.
Safety in numbers, that's all, Cuthbert said.
Do they have the ball? Roland asked. Can you touch it yet?
Yes, they have it. It makes them easy to touch, even though they're going the other way now. Once you find it, it glows like a lamp in a mine shaft.
Does Rhea still have the keeping of it?
I think so. It's awful to touch her.
Jonas is afraid of us, Roland said. He wants more men around him when he comes. That's what it is. What it must be. Unaware that he was both right and badly out in his reckoning. Unaware that for one of the few times since they had left Gilead, he had lapsed into a teenager's disastrous certainty.
What do we do? Alain asked.
Sit here. Listen. Wait. They'll bring the ball this way again if they're going to Hanging Rock. They'll have to.
Susan? Cuthbert asked. Susan and Shimi, what about them? How do we know they're all right?
I suppose that we don't. Roland sat down, cross-legged, with Rusher's trailing reins in his lap. But Jonas and his men will be back soon enough, and when they come, we'll do what we must. 11. Susan hadn't wanted to sleep inside. The hut felt wrong to her without Roland. She had left Shimi huddled under the old hides in the corner and taken her own blankets outside. She sat in the hut's doorway for a little while, looking up at the stars and praying for Roland in her own fashion. When she began to feel a little better, she lay down on one blanket and pulled the other over her. It seemed an eternity since Maria had shaken her out of her heavy sleep, and the open-mouthed glottal snores drifting out of the hut didn't bother her much. She slept with her head pillowed on one arm, and didn't wake when 20 minutes later Shimi came to the doorway, blinked at her sleepily, and then walked off into the grass to urinate. The only one to notice him was Capricoso, who stuck out his long muzzle and took a nip at Shimi's butt as the boy passed him. Shimi, still mostly asleep, reached back and pushed the muzzle away. He knew Cappy's tricks well enough, so he did. Susan dreamed of the willow grove, bird and bear and hare and fish. And what woke her wasn't Shimi's return from his necessary, but a cold circle of steel pressing into her neck. There was a loud click that she recognized at once from the sheriff's office, a pistol being cocked.
The willow grove faded from the eye of her mind. "Shine, little sunbeam," said a voice. For a moment, her bewildered, half-waking mind tried to believe it was yesterday, and Maria wanted her to get up and out of Seafront before whoever had killed Mayor Thorin and Chancellor Reimer could come back and kill her as well. No good. It wasn't the strong light of mid-morning that her eyes opened upon, but the ash-pallid glow of 5 o'clock. Not a woman's voice, but a man's, and not a hand shaking her shoulder, but the barrel of a gun against her neck. She looked up and saw a lined, narrow face framed by white hair, lips no more than a scar, eyes the same faded blue as Roland's. Eldred Jonas. The man standing behind him had bought her own dad drinks once upon a happier time, Hash Renfrew. A third man, one of Jonas's quartet, ducked into the hut. Freezing terror filled her midsection, some for her, some for Shimi. She wasn't sure the boy would even understand what was happening to them. These are two of the three men who tried to kill him, she thought. He'll understand that much. Here you are, Sunbeam, here you come, Jonas said companionably, watching her blink away the sleep fog. Good. You shouldn't be napping all the way out here on your own, not a pretty size such as yourself. But don't worry, I'll see you get back to where you belong. His eyes flicked up as the redhead with the cloak stepped out of the hut. Alone? What you got in there, Clay, anything? Ranald shook his head. All still on the horse, I reckon. Shimi, Susan thought. Where are you, Shimi? Jonas reached out and caressed one of her breasts briefly. Nice, he said, tender and sweet. No wonder Dearborn likes you.
Get your filthy blue-marked hand off me, you bastard!
Smiling, Jonas did as she bid. He turned his head and regarded the mule. I know this one. It belongs to my good friend Coral, along with everything else you've turned livestock thief. Shameful, shameful, this younger generation, don't you agree, Si Renfrew? But her father's old associate said nothing. His face was carefully blank, and Susan thought he might be just the tiniest tad ashamed of his presence here. Jonas turned back to her, his thin lips curved in the semblance of a benevolent smile. Well, after murder, I suppose stealing a mule comes easy, don't it? She said nothing, only watched as Jonas stroked Cappy's muzzle. What all were they hauling, those boys, that it took a mule to put it on?
Shrouds, she said through numb lips, for you and all your friends. A fearful heavy load it made, too, near broke the poor animal's back.
There's a saying in the land I come from, Jonas said, still smiling. Clever girls go to hell. Ever heard it? He went on stroking Cappy's nose. The mule liked it. His neck was thrust out to its full length, his stupid little eyes half closed with pleasure. Has it crossed your mind that fellas who unload their pack animals, split up what it was carrying, and take the goods away, usually ain't coming back? Susan said nothing. You've been left high and dry, Sunbeam. Fast fucked is usually fast forgot, sad to say. Do you know where they went?
Yes, she said.
Her voice was low, barely a whisper. Jonas looked pleased. If he was to tell, things might go easier for you. Would you agree, Renfrew?
Aye, Renfrew said. They're traitors, Susan, for the good man. If you know where they are or what they're up to, tell us.
Keeping her eyes fixed on Jonas, Susan said, Come closer. Her numbed lips didn't want to move, and it came out sounding like Kung Gloser, but Jonas understood and leaned forward, stretching his neck in a way that made him look absurdly like Capricoso. When he did, Susan spat in his face. Jonas recoiled, lips twisting in surprise and revulsion.
Ah, bitch!
He cried, and launched a full-swung, open-handed blow that drove her to the ground. She landed at full length on her side, with black stars exploding across her field of vision. She could already feel her right cheek swelling like a balloon and thought if he'd hit an inch or two lower, he might have broken my neck. Mayhap that would have been best. She raised her hand to her nose and wiped blood from the right nostril. Jonas turned to Renfrew, who had taken a single step forward and then stopped himself.
Put her on her horse and tie her hands in front of her. Tight.
He looked down at Susan, then kicked her in the shoulder hard enough to send her rolling toward the hut.
Spit on me, would you? Spit on Elder Jonas, would you, you bitch?
Reynolds was holding out his neckerchief. Jonas took it, wiped the spittle from his face with it, then dropped into a hunker beside her. He took a handful of her hair and carefully wiped the neckerchief with it. Then he hauled her to her feet. Tears of pain now peeped from the corners of her eyes, but she kept silent.
I may never see your friend again, sweet Sue, with the tender little titties, but I've got you, ain't I? Yeah. And if Dearborn gives us trouble, I'll give you double. And make sure Dearborn knows you may count on it.
His smile faded, and he gave her a sudden bitter shove that almost sent her sprawling again.
Now get mounted, and do it before I decide to change your face a little with my knife.
12. Shimi watched from the grass, terrified and silently crying, as Susan spit in the bad coffin hunter's face and was knocked to the ground, hit so hard the blow might have killed her. He almost rushed out then, but something, it could have been his friend Arthur's voice in his head, told him that would only get him killed. He watched as Susan mounted. One of the other men, not a coffin hunter, but a big rancher Shimi had seen in the rest from time to time, tried to help, but Susan pushed him away with the sole of her boot. The man stood back with a red face.
Don't make him mad, Susan, Shimi thought. Oh, gods, don't do that. They'll hit you some more. Oh, your poor face. And you got a nosebleed, so you do.
Last chance, Jonas told her.
Where are they and what do they mean to do?
Go to hell, she said.
He smiled, a thin, hurty smile.
Likely I'll find you there when I arrive, he said.
Then, to the other coffin hunter, you check the place careful?
Whatever they had, they took it, the redhead answered. The only thing they left was Dearborn's punch bunny.
That made Jonas laugh meany-mean as he climbed on board his own horse.
Come on, he said, let's ride.
They went back into the bad grass. It closed around them, and it was as if they had never been there, except that Susan was gone, and so was Cappy. The big rancher riding beside Susan had been leading the mule. When he was sure they weren't going to return, Shimi walked slowly back into the clearing, doing up the button on top of his pants as he came. He looked from the way Roland and his friends had gone to the one in which Susan had been taken. Which? A moment's thought made him realize there was no choice. The grass out here was tough and springy. The path Roland and Elaine and good old Arthur Heath, so Shimi still thought of him and always would, had taken, was gone. The one made by Susan and her captors, on the other hand, was still clear, and perhaps if he followed her, he could do something for her, help her. Walking at first, then jogging, as his fear that they might double back and catch him dissipated, Shimi went in the direction Susan had been taken. He would follow her most of that day. 13. Cuthbert, not the most sanguine of personalities in any situation, grew more and more impatient as the day brightened toward true dawn. It's reaping, he thought, finally reaping, and here we sit with our knives sharpened and not a thing in the world to cut. Twice he asked Elaine what he heard. The first time Elaine only grunted. The second time he asked what Bert expected him to hear was someone yapping away in his ear like that. Cuthbert, who did not consider two inquiries 15 minutes apart as yapping away, wandered off and sat morosely in front of his horse. After a bit, Roland came over and sat down beside him. Waiting, Cuthbert said. That's what most of our time in Magus has been about, and it's the thing I do worst.
We won't have to do it much longer, Roland said.
14. Jonas's company reached the place where Fran Lengel's party had made a temporary camp about an hour after the sun had topped the horizon.
Quint, Rhea, and Renfrew's Vax were already there and drinking coffee, Jonas was glad to see. Langill started forward, saw Susan riding with her hands tied, and actually drew back a step, as if he wanted to find a corner to hide in. There were no corners out here, however, so he stood fast. He did not look happy about it, however. Susan nudged her horse forward with her knees, and when Reynolds tried to grab her shoulder, she dipped it to the side, temporarily eluding him.
"Why, Francis Langill, imagine meeting you here."
"Susan, I'm sorry to see you so," Langill said.
His flush crept closer and closer to his brow, like a tide approaching a seawall.
"It's bad company you've fallen in with, girl, and in the end bad company always leaves you to face the music alone."
Susan actually laughed.
"Bad company," she said. "Ah, you'd know about that, wouldn't you, Fran?"
He turned, awkward and stiff in his embarrassment. She raised one booted foot, and before anyone could stop her, kicked him squarely between the shoulder blades. He went down on his stomach, his whole face widening in shocked surprise.
"No, you don't, you bold cunt!"
Renfrew shouted, and fetched her a wallop to the side of the head. It was on the left, and at least even things up a bit, she would think later, when her mind cleared and she was capable of thinking. She swayed in the saddle, but kept her seat. And she never looked at Renfrew, only at Langill, who had now managed to get to his hands and knees. He wore a deeply dazed expression.
"You killed my father!" she screamed at him. "You killed my father, you cowardly, sneaking excuse for a man!"
She looked at the party of ranchers and Vax, all of them staring at her now.
"There he is, Fran Langill, head of the Horsemen's Association, as low as sneak as ever walked, low as coyote shit, low as that's enough,"
Jonas said, watching with some interest as Langill scuttled back to his men. And yes, Susan was bitterly delighted to see it was a full-fledged scuttle, with his shoulders hunched. Rhea was cackling, rocking from side to side, and making a sound like fingernails on a piece of slate. The sound shocked Susan, but she wasn't a bit surprised by Rhea's presence in this company.
"It could never be enough," she said,
looking from Jonas to Langill with an expression of contempt so deep it seemed bottomless.
"For him it could never be enough."
"Well, perhaps. But you did quite well in the time you had, Lady Sy. Few could have done better. And listen to the witch cackle, like salt in his wounds, I wot. But we'll shut her up soon enough." Then, turning his head, "Clay?"
Reynolds rode up.
"Think you can get Sunbeam back to Seafront all right?"
"I think so."
Reynolds tried not to show the relief he felt at being sent back east instead of west. He had begun to have a bad feeling about Hanging Rock, Letigo, the tankers, about the whole show, really. God knew why.
"Now?"
"Give it another minute," Jonas said. "Mayhap there's going to be a spot of killing right here. Who knows? But it's the unanswered questions that makes it worthwhile getting up in the morning, even when a man's leg aches like a tooth with a hole in it, wouldn't you say so?"
"I don't know, Aldred."
"Cy Renfrew, watch our pretty Sunbeam a minute. I have a piece of property to take back."
His voice carried well, he had meant that it should, and Rhea's cackles cut off suddenly, as if severed out of her throat with a hooking knife. Smiling, Jonas walked his horse toward the black cart with its jostling show of gold symbols. Reynolds rode on his left, and Jonas sensed rather than saw DePape fall in on his right. Roy was a good enough boy, really. His head was a little soft, but his heart was in the right place, and you didn't have to tell him everything. For every step forward Jonas's horse took, Rhea shrank back a little in the cart. Her eyes shifted from side to side in their deep sockets, looking for a way out that wasn't there.
"Keep away from me, you chary man," she cried, raising a hand toward him.
With the other, she clutched the sack with the ball in it ever more tightly.
"Keep away, or I'll bring the lightning and strike you dead where you sit your horse. Your hairier friends, too."
Jonas thought Roy hesitated briefly at that, but Clay never did, nor did Jonas himself. He guessed there was a great lot she could do, or that there had been at one time. But that was before the hungry glass had entered her life. "Give it up to me," he said. He reached the side of her wagon and held his hand out for the bag. "It's not yours and never was. One day you'll doubtless have the good man's thanks for keeping it so well as you have, but now you must give it up." She screamed, a sound of such piercing intensity that several of the vaqueros dropped their tin coffee cups and clapped their hands over their ears. At the same time, she nodded her hand through the drawstring and raised the bag over her head. The curved shape of the ball swung back and forth at the bottom of it like a pendulum.
"I'll not," she howled. "I'll smash it on the ground before I give it up to the lots of you."
Jonas doubted if the ball would break, not hurled by her weak arms onto the trampled, springy mat of the bad grass, but he didn't think he would have occasion to find out one way or the other. "Clay," he said, "draw your gun." He didn't need to look at Clay to see that he'd done it. He saw the frantic way her eyes shifted to the left where Clay sat his horse.
"I'm going to have a count," Jonas said. "Just a short one. If I get to three and she hasn't passed that bag over, blow her ugly head off."
"Aye."
"One," Jonas said, watching the ball pendulum back and forth at the bottom of the upheld bag. It was glowing. He could see dull pink even through the cloth.
"Two. Enjoy hell, Rhea. Goodbye."
"Three here,"
she screamed, thrusting it out toward him and shielding her face with the crooked hook of her free hand.
"Here, take it, and may it damn you the way it's damned me."
"Thank you, Si." He grabbed the bag just below the draw top and yanked. Rhea screamed again as the string skinned her knuckles and tore off one of her nails. Jonas hardly heard. His mind was a white explosion of exultation. For the first time in his long professional life, he forgot his job, his surroundings, and the 6,000 things that could get him killed on any day. He had it. He had it. By all the graves of all the gods, he had the fucking thing.
"Mine," he thought, and that was all.
He somehow restrained the urge to open the bag and stick his head inside it, like a horse sticking its head into a bag of oats, and looped the drawstring over the pommel of his saddle twice instead. He took in a breath as deep as his lungs would allow, then expelled it.
"Better. A little."
"Roy?
Ah, Jonas?"
It would be good to get out of this place, Jonas thought, and not for the first time, to get away from these hicks. He was sick of I and ye, and so it is, sick to his bones.
"Roy, well, give the bitch a 10 count this time. If she isn't out of my sight by then, you have my permission to blow her ass off. Now, let's see if you can do the counting. I'll be listening close, so mind you don't skip any."
"One," DePape said eagerly. "Two, three, four..."
Spitting curses, Rhea snatched up the reins of the cart and spanked the pony's back with them. The pony laid its ears back and jerked the cart forward so vigorously that Rhea went tumbling backward off the cantboard, her feet up, her white and bony shins showing above her ankle-high black shoes and mismatched wool stockings. The vaqueros laughed. Jonas laughed himself. It was pretty funny, all right, seeing her on her back with her pins in the air.
"Five,"
DePape said, laughing so hard he was hiccuping.
"Six.
Rhea climbed back up, flopped onto the cantboard again with all the grace of a dying fish, and peered around at them, wall-eyed and sneering.
"I curse ye all,"
she screamed. It cut through them, stilling their laughter, even as the cart bounced toward the edge of the trampled clearing.
"Every last one of ye! Ye and ye and ye!"
Her crooked finger pointed last at Jonas.
"Thief! Miserable thief!"
"As though it was yours," Jonas marveled, although "mine" was the first word to occur to him once he had taken possession of it. "As though such a wonder could ever belong to a backcountry reader of rooster gut such as you." The cart bounced its way into the bad grass, the pony pulling hard with its ears laid back. The old woman's scream served to drive it better than any whip could have done. The black slipped into the green. They saw the cart flicker like a conjurer's trick, and then it was gone. For a long time yet, however, they heard her shrieking her curses, calling death down upon them beneath the demon moon. 15.
Go on, Jonas told Clay Reynolds. Take our sunbeam back. And if you want to stop on the way and make some use of her, why, be my guest.
He glanced at Susan as he said this to see what effect it might be having, but he was disappointed. She looked dazed, as if the last blow Renfrew had dealt her had scrambled her brains, at least temporarily.
Just make sure she gets to Coral at the end of all the fun.
I will.
Any message for Cythorin? Tell her to keep the wench someplace safe until she hears from me.
And why don't you stay with her, Clay?
Coral, I mean. Come tomorrow, I don't think we'll have to worry about this one anymore. But Coral, ride with her to Ritzy when she goes. Be her escort-like.
Reynolds nodded. Better and better. Seafront it would be, and that was fine. He might like a little taste of the girl once he got her there, but not on the way. Not under the ghostly full daytime demon moon.
Go on then, get started.
Reynolds led her across the clearing, aiming for a point well away from the bent swath of grass where Rhea had made her exit. Susan rode silently, downcast eyes fixed on her bound wrists. Jonas turned to face his men.
The three young fellas from Inworld have broken their way out of jail with that haughty young bitch's help, he said, pointing at Susan's departing back.
There was a low, growling murmur from the men. That Will Dearborn and his friends were free, they had known. That Cy Delgado had helped them escape, they had not. And it was perhaps just as well for her that Reynolds was at that moment leading her into the bad grass and out of sight.
Never mind, Jonas shouted, pulling their attention back to him.
He reached out a stealthy hand and caressed the curve at the bottom of the drawstring bag. Just touching the ball made him feel as if he could do anything, and with one hand tied behind his back at that.
Never mind her and never mind them.
His eyes moved from Lengel to Wertner to Croydon to Brian Hookey to Roy DePape.
We're close to 40 men, going to join another 150. They're three, and not one a day over 16. Are you afraid of three little boys?
No, they cried.
If we run on them, my cullies, what will we do? Kill them!
The shout so loud that it sent rooks rising up into the morning sun, cawing their displeasure as they commenced the hunt for more peaceful surroundings. Jonas was satisfied. His hand was still on the sweet curve of the ball, and he could feel it pouring strength into him. Pink strength, he thought, and grinned.
Come on, boys. I want those tankers in the woods west of Eyebolt before the home folks light their reap night bonfire.
16. Shimi, crouched down in the grass and peering into the clearing, was nearly run over by Rhea's black wagon. The screaming, gibbering witch passed so close to him that he could smell her sour skin and dirty hair. If she had looked down, she couldn't have missed seeing him, and undoubtedly would have turned him into a bird or a bumbler, or maybe even a mosquito. The boy saw Jonas pass custody of Susan to the one in the cloak, and began working his way around the edge of the clearing. He heard Jonas haranguing the men, many of whom Shimi knew. It shamed him to know how many mages cowboys were doing that bad coffin hunter's bidding, but paid no attention to what he was saying. Shimi froze in place as they mounted up, momentarily scared they would come in his direction, but they rode the other way, west. The clearing emptied almost as if by magic, except it wasn't entirely empty. Capricoso had been left behind, his lead trailing on the beaten grass. Cappy looked after the departing riders, brayed once, as if to tell them they could all go to hell, then turned and made eye contact with Shimi, who was peering out into the clearing. The mule flicked his ears at the boy and tried to graze. He lipped the bad grass a single time, raised his head, and brayed at Shimi as if to say this was all the inn boy's fault. Shimi stared thoughtfully at Capricoso, thinking of how much easier it was to ride than to walk. Gods, yes. But that second bray decided him against it. The mule might give one of his disgusted cries at the wrong time and alert the man who had Susan.
"You'll find your way home, I reckon," Shimi said. "So long, pal. So long, good old Cappy. See you farther down the path."
He found the path made by Susan and Reynolds and began to trot after them once more. 17.
"They're coming again," Alain said, a moment before Roland sensed it himself, a brief flicker in his head like pink lightning.
"All of them."
Roland hunkered in front of Cuthbert. Cuthbert looked back at him without even a suggestion of his usual foolish good humor.
"Much of it's on you," Roland said, then tapped the slingshot. "And on that."
"I know. How much have you got in the armory?"
"Almost 4 dozen steel balls."
Bert held up a cotton bag, which had in more settled times held his father's tobacco.
"Plus assorted fireworks in my saddlebag."
"How many big bangers?"
"Enough, Roland."
Unsmiling.
With the laughter gone from them, he had the hollow eyes of just one more killer.
"Enough."
Roland ran a hand down the front of the serape he wore, letting his palm reacquaint itself with the rough weave. He looked at Cuthbert's, then at Alain's, telling himself again that it could work, yes, as long as they held their nerve and didn't let themselves think of it in terms of 3 against 40 or 50. It could work.
"The ones out at Hanging Rock will hear the shooting once it starts, won't they?" Al asked.
Roland nodded. "With the wind blowing from us to them, there's no doubt of that."
"We'll have to move fast, then."
"We'll go as best we can."
Roland thought of standing between the tangled green hedges behind the great hall, David the Hawk on his arm, and a sweat of terror trickling down his back.
"I think you die today," he had told the Hawk, and he had told it true. Yet he himself had lived and passed his test and walked out of the testing corridor facing east. Today it was Cuthbert and Alain's turn to be tested, not in Gilead, in the traditional place of proving behind the Great Hall, but here in Magus, on the edge of the Badgrass, in the desert, and in the canyon. Eyebolt Canyon.
"Prove or die," Alain said, as if reading the run of the gunslinger's thoughts. "That's what it comes down to."
"Yes, that's what it always comes down to in the end. How long before they get here, do you think?"
"An hour, at least, I'd say. Likely two.
They'll be running a watch and go."
Alain nodded.
"I think so, yes."
"That's not good," Cuthbert said.
"Jonas is afraid of being ambushed in the grass," Roland said. "Maybe of us setting fire to it around him. They'll loosen up when they get into the clear."
"You hope," Cuthbert said.
Roland nodded gravely.
"Yes, I hope."
XVIII.
At first, Reynolds was content to lead the girl along the broken back trail at a fast walk. But about 30 minutes after leaving Jonas, Lengil, and the rest, he broke into a trot. Pylon matched Reynolds's horse easily, and just as easily when 10 minutes later he upped their speed to a light but steady run. Susan held to the horn of her saddle with her bound hands and rode easily at Reynolds's right, her hair streaming out behind her. She thought her face must be quite colorful. The skin of her cheeks felt raised at least 2 inches higher than usual, welted and tender. Even the passing wind stung a little. At the place where the bad grass gave way to the drop, Reynolds stopped to give the horses a blow. He dismounted himself, turned his back to her, and took a piss. As he did, Susan looked up along the rise of land and saw the great herd, now untended and unraveling at the edges.
They had done that much, perhaps. It wasn't much, but it was something.
"Do you need to do the necessary?" Reynolds asked. "I'll help you down if you do, but don't say no now and whine about it later."
"Ye're afraid. Big, brave regulator that ye are. Ye're scared, ain't ye? Aye. Coffin, tattoo, and all."
Reynolds tried a contemptuous grin. It didn't fit his face very well this morning.
"You ought to leave the fortune-telling to those that are good at it, missy. Now, do you need a necessary stop or not?"
No. And ye are afraid. Of what?
Reynolds, who only knew that his bad feeling hadn't left him when he left Jonas, as he'd hoped it would, bared his tobacco-stained teeth at her.
If you can't talk sensible, just shut up.
Why don't you let me go? Perhaps my friends will do the same for you when they catch us up.
This time Reynolds grunted laughter, which was almost genuine. He swung himself into his saddle, hawked, spat. Overhead, Demon Moon was a pale and bloated ball in the sky.
"You can dream, Miss Si," he said. "Dreamin's free. But you ain't never gonna see those three again. They're for the worms, they are. Now let's ride." They rode.
19. Cordelia hadn't gone to bed at all on Reaping Eve. She sat the night through in her parlor chair, and although there was sewing on her lap, she had not put a single stitch in nor picked one out. Now, as morning's light brightened toward 10 o'clock, she sat in the same chair, looking out at nothing. What was there to look at, anyway? Everything had come down with a smash. All her hopes of the fortune Thorne would settle on Susan and Susan's child, perhaps while he still lived, certainly in his dead letter. All her hopes of ascending to her proper place in the community, all her plans for the future, swept away by two willful young people who couldn't keep their pants up. She sat in her old chair with her knitting on her lap and the ashes Susan had smeared on her cheek standing out like a brand, and thought, "They'll find me dead in this chair some day, old, poor, and forgotten, that ungrateful child, after all I did for her." What roused her was a weak scratching at the window. She had no idea how long it had been going on before it finally intruded on her consciousness, but when it did, she laid her needlework aside and got up to see. A bird, perhaps. Or children playing reaping jokes, unaware that the world had come to an end. Whatever it was, she would shoo it away. Cordelia saw nothing at first. Then, as she was about to turn away, she spied a pony and cart at the edge of the yard. The cart was a little disquieting, black, with gold symbols overpainted, and the pony in the shaft stood with its head lowered, not grazing, looking as if it had been run half to death. She was still frowning out at this when a twisted, filthy hand rose in the air directly in front of her and began to scratch at the glass again. Cordelia gasped and clapped both hands to her bosom as her heart took a startled leap in her chest. She backed up a step and gave a little shriek as her calf brushed the fender of the stove. The long, dirty nails scratched twice more, then fell away. Cordelia stood where she was for a moment, irresolute, then went to the door, stopping at the wood box to pick up a chunk of ash which fitted her hand. Just in case. Then she jerked the door open, went to the corner of the house, drew in a deep, steadying breath, and went around to the garden side, raising the ash chunk as she did.
"Get out, whoever you are! Scat, before I—"
Her voice was stilled by what she saw. An incredibly old woman crawling through the frost-killed flower bed next to the house, crawling toward her. The crone's stringy white hair, what remained of it, hung in her face. Sores festered on her cheeks and brow. Her lips had split and drizzled blood down her pointed, warty chin. The corneas of her eyes had gone a filthy gray-yellow, and she panted like a cracked bellows as she moved.
"Good woman, help me," the specter gasped. "Help me, if you will, for I'm about done up."
The hand holding the chunk of ash sagged. Cordelia could hardly believe what she was seeing.
"Rhea?" she whispered. "Is it Rhea?"
"Why?"
Rhea whispered, crawling relentlessly through the dead silk flowers, dragging her hands through the cold earth.
"Help me."
Cordelia retreated a step, her makeshift bludgeon now hanging at her knee.
"No, I can't have such as thee in my house.
I'm sorry to see you so, but I have a reputation, you can. Folk watch me close, so they do.
She glanced at the high street as she said this, as if expecting to see a line of townspeople outside her gate, watching eagerly, avid to fleet their wretched gossip on its lying way. But there was no one there. Hambry was quiet, its walks and byways empty, the customary joyous noise of reaping fair day stilled. She looked back at the thing which had fetched up in her dead flowers.
"Your niece did this,"
the thing in the dirt whispered.
"All her fault."
Cordelia dropped the chunk of wood. It clipped the side of her ankle, but she hardly noticed. Her hands curled into fists before her.
"Help me," Rhea whispered. "I know where she is. We have work, us two. Women's work.